Welcome to this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. Thanks for joining me again today. The case we have today, our case of the week, is United States versus Clark, and this is our second edition for the new year. 2018-02 is the edition. This case is our first case from 2018, and from January 3rd is when the opinion was issued, and again, it's out of the First Circuit up there in New England. So let's take a look at the case. An interesting set of facts and some and things we're going to have to talk about with some of these facts as well to kind of make heads or tails out of some of it. So before I get started, give you your key phrases for this particular episode. It's going to involve a vehicle stop, Terry frisk, issues regarding the scope of the frisk, issues regarding the exclusionary rule and the exception to the exclusionary rule, the concept of inevitable discovery. Key cases, some cases that you ought to be very familiar with, especially the first and the last one, Rodriguez versus United States, which came out a couple of years ago. Very illustrative and informative case. Hebel versus the Sixth Judicial District Circuit, Brenland versus California, and Nix v. Williams. Although the Nix v. Williams case is not actually cited in this particular case, it is cited in the briefs below, and it is the Supreme Court decision that supports some arguments that were made. And so I included that in the key cases as well. Okay, so let's take a look at the facts and see what was going on here. And we have this case comes to us from Maine, up there in Saco, Maine. The Saco Police Department had an officer who fairly new. He was only been on the job for about a year, and he conducts a traffic stop. It was July 20th of 2015, and there was a vehicle that Officer Magoon observed driving erratically and then also passed someone at a red light and ran the red light. At the time of the stop, like I said, he'd been with the force for about a year, and when he went to approach, he approached the vehicle. The driver was one Megan Maieta, and she was driving the vehicle, and she had a passenger in the vehicle with her. And the passenger is Joseph E. Clark, who is the defendant in this case. So Officer Magoon asked Maieta for her information, her driver's license, copies of the registration, insurance, the things that you ask for when you're an LEO when you make a traffic stop. Officer Magoon then asked Clark if he had any identification. Clark said he didn't have any Maine identification and that the only identification he had was from the state of Georgia, but he didn't have it with him because he had lost it. Officer Magoon asked Clark how long he'd lived in Maine, to which Clark answered 5 years. So you've got a guy that says he doesn't have Maine identification, he's lived in the state 5 years. Clark identified himself as Joseph Leo Clark. So Joseph L. Clark is how he identified himself. Joseph Leo Clark. He also volunteered at this point that his birth date was August 6, 1986. Officer Magoon starts talking to Maieta again, the driver. According to testimony that Officer Magoon provided, if Clark at that point had just not said anything, he would have made no further inquiry at all into Clark's identity. But while he's talking to Maieta, Clark interrupted him and voluntarily provided him with his Social Security number and his age. And Magoon heard the first three numbers of Clark's Social Security number as 256, but they said the recordings of the stop, of the dash cam the recording off the body cam, show that the Clark actually said the number beginning with 257. And I'll just point out both of those numbers are consistent with a Georgia someone who obtains a Social Security card in the state of Georgia. Clark said he was 26 years old, and this is inconsistent because if his birth date was August 6, 1986, that would not his he wouldn't be 26, he'd be 28. And so the age that he's given is inconsistent with the age that he would have if the birthday was correct. So now Officer Magoon thinks that Clark's not giving him accurate information, and he also looks at his demeanor. He's not looking at him. He's speaking really softly, and so he starts. He's asking him questions, asking him to verify the age. So 3.5 minutes into the stop, He goes, Officer Magoon goes back to his cruiser. He verifies Maeta's identification and tries to verify Clark's identification. Well, he quickly verified Maeta's information, but the database found no match for Clark. So based on the fact that there was not a match, as well as Clark's failure to have main identification despite having lived there for 5 years, Magoon started to become a little concerned that Clark was trying to conceal his real identity. So 6.5 minutes after the initial stop, he returns to the car to confirm who Clark is. He spends some time, a couple minutes, asking Clark for additional information about where he lived and any past contact he had with police. And during this time, another officer, Officer Linden, arrives on the scene. At this point, Clark told Officer Magoon that his birth date was August 25th, 1986. Now, this is a different date than what he told him earlier. So, Officer Magoon asked him again for a third time, "What is your birth date?" And Clark said August 5th of 1986. So now he's given him three separate days: August 5th, August 25th, and August 26th. On three separate times, he's been asked what the birth date is, and three times he's given him something different. After that, another officer radioed Magoon and Officer Linden with a partial match for a Joseph Eugene Clark. Remember, he had told the officers that his name was Joseph Leo Clark, but they said there was a match for a person named Joseph Eugene Clark, a resident of Scarborough, Maine, with a birth date of August 25th, 1983, and with three active arrest warrants. And the description of the person, Joseph E. Clark, in all three of the arrest warrants fit Clark's general description. So once they have this information, Officers Magoon and Linden return to the car again. They ask Clark to repeat his identifying information. He provides them the same Social Security number. But this time, Magoon actually hears Clark begin with the number 257. And now he's mistakenly thinking that earlier he said 256. But that's what he heard. So Magoon orders Clark out of the car. He handcuffs him. Neither officers frisk Clark or notice anything to indicate that he has a weapon. And Clark denies that he's Joseph Eugene Clark and repeatedly says his middle name is Leo, which actually turns out to be false. Stankovic radioed again. Officer Stankovic radioed Officer Magoon again, told him that Joseph Eugene Clark reportedly carried firearms. And he sent a photograph of this person, Joseph Eugene Clark. And because of the image's low quality, Magoon could not determine whether the picture was of Clark, and he requested that Stankovic come to the scene. So now it's been 20 minutes since the initial stop. Stankovic and a newly hired officer in training, Officer Paradis, arrived at the scene. Stankovic at that point felt sure that Clark was the same Joseph Eugene Clark in the photograph and advised Magoon to take Clark back to the station to be fingerprinted. So now what you have is a situation when you go to transport someone, that's an arrest situation. That's an arrest. When you're going to transport someone, putting them in the car handcuffed doesn't necessarily become a de facto arrest, but when you start transporting someone, it does. And so they tell him, says, "Hey, take him back to the station." And this is all based on the arrest warrants. So at this point, they decided to take him back to the station. Now, Magoon called the station, and the sergeant on duty said, "Hey, look, have you frisked the guy yet?" Because the Saco Police Department protocol required officers to pat down a suspect before placing him in a cruiser. And then their policy, when they arrive at the station, they're going to be searched a lot more thoroughly. So the rookie, Paradis, conducted the pat-down search of Clark, and during the pat-down, he felt a lump in the waistband, and he pulled out the object, which turned out to be two plastic bags of heroin and ecstasy. And officers declared they at that point they formally told him he was under arrest, put him in the cruiser where he was transported back to the station. So initially they decided to take him back to the station based on the warrants, but then they did the pat down before formally placing him under arrest, they did the pat down, and then they found the drugs in the waistband, and then they told him he was formally under arrest. That's the point they told him he was formally under arrest. And so you kind of know what's going to happen here. Kind of see where all this is headed. So at trial, you know what the defense attorney's going to do. They're going to use that defense attorney F word and say, hey, that's not fair. And so the defense attorney makes these arguments. There's a number of arguments that are made, including one that's not even included. It wasn't on appeal. But the defense attorney argues first, the extension of the stop for running the stoplight was unreasonable, extending it just to try and determine the identity of the passenger. Made it an unreasonable seizure. Second, the second argument was the scope of the pat down frisk was exceeded because the rookie officer also went into the pockets, stuck a hand into a pocket where nothing was felt. There was nothing apparently from the outside. Saw something on one pocket, asked the guy what it was, and he said it was his keys, and then reached into the other pocket as well. And so the argument was that the scope of the pat down frisk was exceeded by going into the pockets. And then a third argument, and these are alternative arguments, basically saying, hey, look, if I win on one or two, they try to thwart the concept of the inevitable discovery doctrine, which is an exception to the exclusionary rule, arguing that the inevitable discovery doctrine did not apply since the purpose of the frisk was to find out who he was and to see whether or not he had any identification on him and not officer safety. So kind of looking at the subjective intent of why it was that they did took this particular action. Now, at the district court level, the district court the magistrate issued findings, and the findings were accepted by the district court. And the magistrate's findings were that the extension of the stop was reasonable under Rodriguez, and that it was okay. But the pat down of the frisk was exceeded, and that agreed with the defense, but said the evidence that was found is going to be admissible anyway because the inevitable discovery doctrine did apply, and so it went to trial, and there's a conditional plea, and there you go. So you know what's going to happen for it to get up on the circuit court. We got these issues that are lining up. There's a lot of our Fourth Amendment dominoes that are taking place here, and this is a really good case. I mean, it's important that you not just have the right dominoes, but you play them in the right order. That they're in the chronologically things happen. They're in the right place, so one domino can knock down the next domino and eventually get you to the point to where you have that final domino, that plain view seizure. And obviously the exclusionary rule is going to apply if any of these dominoes prior to that plain view seizure is bad. So if the defense can successfully argue that any of these dominoes were bad, then it's going to create problems for the government. And this is just this case, if you review the lower court documentation, it's a very clear case of why it's so important for you to do things in the right order and to line things up and to make sure that you've got your dominoes all in the right line. There's some question here as to whether some of these dominoes were lined up in the proper order, and there are a little bit more of to the facts than what you actually read in the circuit court decision. I've actually read the lower court the motion and the response and the lower court order, and a lot more going on than what was limited up to on appeal up to the circuit court. So the circuit court's going to look at whether or not it agrees with the decision that was made by the lower court, whether or not the duration was reasonable, whether or not the frisk was proper, and if not, whether the exclusionary rule is going to be applied or whether the inevitable discovery doctrine is going to kick in. So here we go with our legal blast from the past. Let's take a look at some of these cases that are going to, these famous and very important Supreme Court decisions that are going to kind of guide the decision as the circuit court is making its order here, its ruling here in this case. A traffic stop, it's important to know, a traffic stop of a vehicle constitutes a seizure of everyone in the vehicle. So your very, very first domino, when it comes to Clark himself, was the seizure of the vehicle a seizure of Clark? And the answer is yes. And that's the Brennan v. California, so decision. So the next case of important case to point out, very famous case, and talked about this a lot when it first came out in 2015. This case came out of the Eighth Circuit, and it did away with a rule of law that the Eighth Circuit had developed called the de minimis rule, to where a traffic stop could be extended for a de minimis amount of time in order to conduct a criminal investigation, as long as it was de minimis, it didn't require any level of suspicion. Well, the Supreme Court unequivocally shot that down, Justice Scalia in the Rodriguez decision back in 2015, eliminated that de minimis rule and said, hey, look, when you conduct a traffic stop, when you make the traffic stop, the stop has to be valid because the stop's a seizure. And there's a judicially recognized exception, a JRE for that warrantless seizure of the vehicle, long enough for you to issue a citation and a summons. It has to be reasonable in duration. And so if you want to extend the traffic stop beyond the amount of time that's required to issue that citation and summons, then there has to be some other reason. There has to be another judicially recognized exception at play. At a minimum, you're going to have turn it into a Terry stop. So while you're conducting the traffic stop, if you develop a reasonable suspicion that the occupants, one or more of the occupants, are engaged in criminal activity, then the traffic stop seamlessly gets converted from a traffic stop under that JRE to a Terry stop under that judicially recognized exception. But it has to be seamless. You have to have the reasonable suspicion to continue the stop in the amount of time that would be reasonable to issue the citation and the summons under the traffic stop. And that's the rule of law with Rodriguez, extending traffic stop beyond the time required to actually issue the summons. And then we've got the Hibbell case, Hibbell. The LEO inquiry as to the identification of a passenger in a vehicle that is stopped is permissible under the Fourth Amendment. We can ask for not just the identification and registration of the driver, we can also ask for that from the passengers. And asking for that is not an impermissible or unreasonable search, or doesn't make the seizure unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. So that's a pretty important legal premise for us to apply in this particular set of facts as well. And then lastly, the concept of the inevitable discovery through lawful means. There are, the exclusionary rule is not statutory. It's a judicial creature. It was created by the court basically to disincentivize the police from violating the Fourth Amendment. I mean, if there was no repercussions for violating the Fourth Amendment and the bad guy still got prosecuted, then there would be no incentive for the law enforcement officers to follow the Fourth Amendment. So the exclusionary rule is intended to exclude evidence for fourth evidence that's collected in violation of the Fourth Amendment as a result of police misconduct. The whole purpose of the rule is to deter police misconduct. So if there's not police misconduct, then the rule doesn't won't be applied. Just because there's a Fourth Amendment violation that leads to the seizure of evidence doesn't automatically mean the exclusionary rule is going to be applied. There might be a situation where there was not misconduct on the part of the LEO. Maybe there was a mistake that was made, a clerical mistake, a warrant that should have been pulled out of the system that wasn't. And so this officer's told, hey, a person's got an arrest warrant out for him, and they make an arrest, and it turns out that there's no arrest warrant. That's not something bad on the part of the officer. And so the exclusionary rule would not apply in that type of situation. There's a number of exceptions based on the limitation of the exclusionary rule and the purpose of it to deter police misconduct. There's a number of exceptions where it will not apply. And one of the exceptions is where it would have been inevitably discovered anyway through lawful means. And the inevitable means very, very quickly, almost imminent, right? That there are already wheels in motion. If you've got an officer that, without a warrant or judicially recognized exception, kicks open a Joey Bag of Donuts front door and goes into his house, and then discovers drugs, let's say, right there inside the door, and which is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and it's misconduct. So you're looking at the exclusionary rule kicking in. But unbeknownst to this officer, the DEA had obtained a warrant and was on their way to the house. And they arrived just 10 minutes after this guy kicks the front door open and goes in. That's an inevitable discovery situation. It would have inevitably been discovered through lawful means. And so that is the exception to the exclusionary rule, the particular one that comes from Nix v. Williams, a Supreme Court decision back in 1984, and as applied in the First Circuit through United States versus Almeida, and that's the case they actually cited in the Supreme Court, or I'm sorry, in this Circuit Court decision. So that's the fundamental rule of law and the basis for it, the whole concept of inevitable discovery. The magistrate said that when they got him back to the station, he would have been searched more thoroughly and they would have discovered it anyway, and that would have been lawful. So therefore, the fact that they found it during that pat down that was improperly conducted doesn't matter because it would have been discovered through lawful means anyway. And so that's the what had happened. That's what the court had said at the lower court level. Well, what did the circuit court say? You know, what did the circuit court do with this case under these facts? Well, the circuit court ruled, based on what we talked about in Rodriguez, that the traffic stop was not unlawfully extended because while the traffic stop was properly taking place and identification was being sought and run, the LEO developed a reasonable suspicion that Clark was lying about the identity. Now, even though it only took a few minutes, just a few minutes into the stop, they already had the information on the driver, on Mayetta. They already knew that she was who she said she was, and the car was legit in all concerns. It wasn't stolen, and registration was current. She wasn't driving on a suspended license. So they were finished with her just a few minutes in, but they were taking more time in order to run the information and the identification on Clark. And the court said that it wasn't unlawfully, that was reasonable. One of the facets and a fact that that I didn't mention particularly here, but the officer said that if he had done nothing but just write her a ticket, if Clark had not been in the car, it would have been about a 20-minute evolution. And so the fact that all this identification information that converted into reasonable suspicion was taking place, and then ultimately probable cause based on the warrant, the outstanding warrants, the three outstanding warrants, that while all this was taking place, the traffic stop was not unlawfully extended. So there wasn't, it was seamless. The transition from the traffic stop, the temporary detention for the traffic stop into the identification, all everything about the identity, and ultimately the probable cause, that was all seamless, and there was no unlawful extension of the traffic stop like there was in Rodriguez. The court stated that the pat down frisk of Clark exceeded the permissible scope. Now, it's important for me to point out, because you might be jumping up and down wondering to yourself, self, what the heck is going on here? But this was conceded by the government on appeal. The government made a tactical decision that they were going to focus on the exclusionary rule, and the applicability of the exclusionary rule. And after all, they had won the day with the lower court decision. So, and so if they can just get the circuit, if they can get the if they can get the circuit court to agree with what the lower court did, then everything's still going to be fine because the lower court did rule that the exclusionary rule would not kick in because of inevitable discovery. And that's exactly what the circuit court did. They said, hey, look, the drugs would have been found anyway when Clark got to the station, and that the three requirements, there's three requirements that are met, that are required and have to be met in order for that to take place. He only focused on the third one, and so and the court was really keen on that. And so they said, hey, look, they would have found the drugs anyway when they got him to the station. And the three requirements under the cited first the First Circuit case that referenced the Nix case, the Supreme Court decision, that the three requirements were met as was ruled in the district court at the district court level, and therefore the government won on appeal. The motion to suppress the evidence that was denied in that decision was affirmed by the circuit court. So there you go. You might got a few minutes left, and I've left a few minutes intentionally because you might be thinking to yourself, well, what about search incident to arrest? You know, and they made that argument in front of the district court and in front of the magistrate. They made the argument, hey, look, once the officer showed up on the scene, Stankovic showed up on the scene and positively identified this person who actually was, by the way, who actually was the person they were looking for. His middle name was not Leo, as he had stated, and he was indeed the person who was named on the warrants. But this officer arrived and identified him and said, "Yeah, this is the guy." At that point, a decision was going to be made to arrest this guy. At that point, it was no longer a detention. There was nothing he could say to them that would result in them telling him to have a nice day and letting him go. In fact, there was actually some questions that were asked after that point, which the defense was successfully able to get excluded, get suppressed because of Miranda violations. Once you go from that detention into arrest-like custody, Miranda's going to get triggered. And they asked him questions after he was positively identified, and they were going to transport him back to the station, which is an arrest. That's when this pat-down frisk took place. Why can't you just say that was an SIA? Why can't you just make the argument that that was a search incident to arrest? And you're not limited in the scope in a search incident to arrest. You're not limited like you are with a Terry frisk, so that kind of pat-down looking for hard objects that can be used as weapons. It's a full-blown search, and you can search them. You can pull their shoes off. You can stick your hands in their pockets. When you're doing a search incident to arrest, it's not limited in any way under that particular JRE, under that judicially recognized exception. They made that argument in front of the magistrate, which I personally think is a really good argument to be made. And the magistrate never really focused on it, never really addressed it. And the district court adopted the magistrate's findings without making any changes to them. So the district court order became what the magistrate's findings were. And even though in the brief and the response to the motion, the government raised the issue, hey, look, even if you believe this was improper as a pat down, this guy was already going to be under arrest. And so we're not limited to that under a search incident to arrest, which you would think would win the day. But that's not where the magistrate didn't even address it. Didn't even mention it in the findings that went to the district court. And so on appeal, they didn't raise it. They just left it. They stuck with dance with the girl what brung you, Sadie Hawkins night, as my grandfather used to say. And that's what they did. They kind of danced with the girl what brung them there. And they went with the district court's rule and having that, the exclusionary rule, the inevitable discovery exception to the exclusionary rule kick in. So there's a good argument to be made there. You got to think about the whole, look, they had to make the decision to arrest the guy based on the warrants and not on the discovery of the drugs. Because if they had arrested the guy based on the discovery of the drugs, then there would not have been an inevitable discovery because the arrest would have been invalid if the frisk was invalid. None of that makes any sense. So the fact that they are invoking inevitable discovery is basically underlining and underscoring the validity of the arrest to begin with. So it would have been a lot cleaner if they'd have just said, hey, this was a valid search incident to arrest. But hey, they took it the way they got it. It was a win. Very good job to the folks out there in the United States at the United States Attorney's Office and the Assistant United States Attorneys that were involved in this did a great job and on appeal and up there in the United States District Court for the District of Maine. So there you go. Time flies when you're having fun. And half an hour whizzed by already. I want to thank you for joining me on this particular episode of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday. Don't forget about the podcast. And there's going to be another really good one coming out today. Go to broadcast.blue, www.broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address. That's actually a domain extension now. Don't put a .com after that. It's broadcast.blue. That's all you have to type in your browser. And you can find all kinds of information, including there's a tab up there for the Brown Bag videos, information regarding our upcoming Brown Bag webinars. If I have to schedule one or reschedule one or not do one, you'll see information on there about that. How to subscribe to the Broadcast Blue audio podcast and information on how to stream the Brown Bag webinar, Wednesday webinar video. And due to popular demand, we're making these things available. A handful of folks always show up live, and it's great to have you here in the room with me. But if you want to watch previous episodes of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday, you do that at the domain www.brownbag.video for all the information on that. Thank you so much for what you do. Thanks again for joining me, and I hope to see you next week.